The legend goes as such. It's 1985, and Phil Collins, drummer, singer, divorce aficionado, had a problem. Phil wants to play the Live Aid show at Wembley, and then, a few hours later, make it to Philadelphia to play the drums for Eric Clapton at the Live Aid show there. And thankfully, science was able to get him there. And when I say science, I mean the Concorde. On this episode of the Oxford Sparks Big Questions podcast, we are looking at the Concorde and asking, will supersonic travel make a comeback? Hello, I'm Emily Elias, and this is the show where we seek out the brightest minds at the University of Oxford, and we ask them the big questions. Get it? Name of the podcast? Big Questions? Okay. To see if the Concorde should be brought out of retirement, we are off to the Oxford airport with a man who is no stranger to the world of aviation.
So I'm Dr. Neil Ashton. Actually, it sounds silly saying doctor. I don't know what it is. From the Oxford E-Research Centre. And my typical day-to-day is the typical academic things of some research, a little bit of teaching here and there, but mainly trying to come up with ways that we can design planes and cars to meet the challenges of the future.
Most people see the Concorde as one of those iconic aircrafts and a technological breakthrough. And yet, it is currently a museum piece. So what happened? Well, to understand why they're no longer flying, Neil says you have to go back, way back, to when the Concorde program began in the 1960s.
Originally, there was three countries working on a Concorde: the Russians, the Americans, and the British and the French. So it was kind of like a Cold War effort, really. And one of the big problems was this sonic boom, the noise that they make as they go supersonic.
The term sonic boom can be a bit misleading. Neil says planes don't just make this noise once when they hit the speed of sound. The so-called boom follows the plane for the entire journey, kind of like when a speedboat is cutting through a still lake.
You have basically a wake, and they call it like a sonic carpet. So, and that typically, for something like Concorde, was about 50 miles across. And so as it's going over, in this, you know, most of the time the sea, everything below it is experiencing that boom continuously as it's moving across its path. So obviously, as an observer, you only hear it once, but it actually is traveling. So that was a problem over land. You've essentially got, if it was going from New York to California, the whole time it's going supersonic, it's constantly putting out this noise that's traveling across the country. So everybody under its path is going to hear it.
So when the Americans were working on their supersonic planes, they did tests to see what the impact would be for people living on the ground below. And Neil says it was a real not-in-my-backyard situation.
They found that there was reports of glass being shattered, people complaining of the disruption to the noise and things like that. And so they actually banned supersonic travel overland. And that essentially killed off the American effort because, you know, obviously one of the big things for the Americans was to go from New York to LA or something. And then I think the Russian one had quite a few dodgy flights and wasn't really working correctly. And so it ended up being the British-French one, which was the one to carry on.
And because of the noise coming from the planes, the Concordes were only allowed to fly over water, hence the transatlantic flight plan, thus shaping a very restricted business model for British Airways and Air France.
And so even with the crashes, even with the price of fuel going up and the issue of how do you look after a plane that is that expensive with its parts and fuel, the fact that it couldn't go supersonic over land really put it at a disadvantage right from the beginnings.
Concordes were making the route from London and Paris to New York for nearly 30 years. In the year 2000, a horrific crash of an Air France jet killed all of the crew and passengers on board. Then, post 9/11, the airline industry starts reeling from a general downturn. And by 2003, the Concorde was put out to pasture. And while it was gone, it was not forgotten.
Over the past maybe 5-10 years, especially over the past 5 years, people have seen that there is a business model for having supersonic, but now focusing really on business travel. Concorde had up to 100 seats, which is actually quite a lot, especially if you're trying to fill the plane. So the idea now is people have seen, well, let's try and have more like 40 passengers or 50 passengers, people who have, you know, got a bit of money and kind of want to get to New York a bit faster. At the moment, it's, I think, 7 hours to get from London to New York, where Concorde was able to do it in 3.5. So there is a desire still from the business community to do that. And that has made people reassess, okay, so what do we actually have to do to really come up with a 2.0, the new Concorde?
And so a reboot is in the works. Flying to Asia and Dubai wasn't really a big part of the business plan when the Concorde was originally flying, but times have changed, and all of the big players are vying for a piece of this potential market. We've got Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and a U.S. startup that's being backed by Sir Richard Branson called Boom. They're all in the race against each other.
So if you think about an aircraft, how do you design one? Well, you could just use your intuition, how it should look based upon some historical data, and you draw it on a piece of paper, you tell some people to make it, and you fly it and you see how good it is. And that's how it used to be done in the early days, but you can imagine that's very expensive every time you come up with a new idea to build it and fly it. The second option is you test it in what they call a wind tunnel. So this thing, you build it, doesn't have to be the same scale, it could be a smaller scale, and you basically put it in a big warehouse and blow air over it. And that's kind of the assumption that it's the same as if it's in the air. The problem with supersonic is that air has to go pretty fast. And so the power and the energy and the facilities to do that becomes quite expensive. In fact, very expensive. And there's only a few places in the world that have those facilities.
Which brings us, conveniently, to Neil's brand of research. So, you are trying to build the next supersonic jets of the future. You want to make them faster. And more importantly, you want to make them quieter and cheaper. So to do this, you're going to need a supercomputer.
Computational fluid dynamics is essentially a virtual wind tunnel where completely on a computer screen, essentially, you can draw an object like a Concorde and you can simulate what the airflow would do around it. And that means that you can try lots of ideas, lots of different shapes, find out how good they are without having to build anything. So that really helps, because really what you're trying to do is optimize something. You're trying to make it quieter, so you think, okay, we've studied some of the physics, we know that if we make it a little bit longer, we can reduce the power of these shock waves which are causing the noise. But it's a subtle game, and building it every time would be too expensive. So I think really the past 10, 20 years, by mainly people like NASA, is to work on these methods that they're good enough, accurate enough to give the right answers, and that's now possible.
When you imagine a supercomputer, you're probably thinking of a really big computer, you know, something that's the size of a football field. Well, sorry to burst your imagination bubble, but that's not really what Neil's working with when he's making these aeronautic simulations. He says it's more like a collection of computers that are all working together in a binary chain gang.
So the easiest way to explain this would be if I was to ask somebody to write a book for me, and I have written it all out by hand, and I ask one person to type it up. It's 1,000 pages. So it might take a month to write all that up in on the computer and send it to me. But the other alternative idea is that I could say, well, there's 1,000 pages, so how about I get 1,000 people and give them one page each, and they work on it at the same time. So each person writes a page, might take them a day, but they're all doing it exactly the same time. And they all send it to me and I put it together. So instead of it taking a month for one person, I've now used 1,000 people who are all doing it at the same time, they do it in a day. So that's essentially how the supercomputer makes things faster. It says, if I want to simulate the flow over a Concorde, instead of one computer doing it, I will split it up, the task, into 1,000 little bits of Concorde. And each bit can calculate it and all send it back. And you get, ideally, it should be 1,000 times faster. It simply was not possible to do the simulations of something like Concorde accurately 40 years ago because the computer was not big enough. So the simulation might take a year to run. And you can't wait a year, one simulation to run. Literally, what would take a year then might take just a day now.
Currently at NASA, there is a quiet supersonic technology program that's up and running. In the next 5 years, they are actually planning on building a prototype aircraft with Lockheed Martin to prove that they can do it. But there is a wild card in all of this. He's orange, he's on Twitter, and he has power over NASA's budget.
You know, if NASA gets their funding cut, it will kill off the research just at the point where it's needed. Most of the big companies won't take it on because it's too much fundamental research, you know, it's not worth it for them. But the one saving grace could be, can you imagine Trump having a supersonic plane and kitting it out, you know, that it only has 5 seats and it has a desk in there and all this, and him turning up at world summits in a supersonic plane? I mean, you can kind of see how that might massage his ego a little bit to say, hey, look, I've got the best plane. Part of me thinks, I wonder if they make these planes cheap enough, whether you might get some of these super rich actually having them as their own private jets.
Neil's best guess, the earliest we could see supersonic planes at our airports?
I was a betting man that it would probably be maybe like 2035, something like that.
Yeah, but how expensive would that ticket be?
Well, yeah,
like, would you be on the first flight?
No, definitely not.
Time for the credits. This podcast was brought to you by Oxford Sparks for the University of Oxford, with music by John Lyons, and a special thanks to Dr. Neil Ashton. Tell us what you think of this podcast. You can go to Twitter. You can tweet us at Oxford Sparks. You can find us on Facebook. And of course, we have a website, oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk. I'm Emily Elias, and next time on the podcast, we're asking, how do you educate a driverless car? Bye for now.